I was planning on introducing you as educator, union activist, and former federal NDP candidate for Haldimand Norfolk. Is that right?
Perfect. I'm sure.
Sounds good. Or you know, you could try Haldimand Norfolk, but hey, whatever. You know.
Okay.
Honestly, I think I like Ben's more.
I'll do my best. Welcome to the latest episode of Out of Left Field. As always, we are podcasting from the Gulag Archipelago of Soviet Kanakistan, otherwise known as beautiful Vancouver Island. Apologies for the brief hiatus, but we're back and we got a bunch of new interviews planned. Obligatory, we're part of the Ricochet Podcast Network, which is a bunch of other podcasts, lefty podcasts in Canada. And thanks to all of our patrons who support the show. If you want to support the show, you can head down to patreon.com/outofleftfieldpodcast. That being said, we have got our regular cast of characters today. Mackenzie. Mackenzie?
Yeah, sorry. I was muted.
Anthony.
Hi. Yeah, hi. Checking in. How's it going, everybody?
Yeah, we're doing another, since Rona is back on Vancouver Island, we're doing another socially distanced episode. So, as the sky is blotted out by forest fire smoke from the south, not unlike a nuclear winter, and Rona ravages through our communities, leaving death and destruction in its wake, we prepare for a brand new catastrophe on our hands. Back to school! Joining us today is a longtime listener, first-time caller, educator, union activist, and former federal NDP candidate for, I'm going to do my best, Haldimand Norfolk, Ontario, Adrian Roberts. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to for you to have me on. I really appreciate it. And I know the people out in Haldimand Norfolk will get a kick out of this as well.
Thank you for that. Well, thanks. Yeah, we really appreciate your time. And, you know, I think that the whole back to school thing is fills a lot of people with existential dread, given the prevalence of the novel coronavirus. So tell us about, you know, in your capacity as a secondary school teacher, tell us about schools reopening during the pandemic. What are some of your biggest concerns and what are your thoughts on the whole situation?
We came back, we've been away for 7 months. So in Ontario, we closed the schools just before March break and went through that whole process of this remote learning. So we've had our own trials over the past 7 months, our own up and downs, and now we're back to school. And so Ontario, we have a couple different plans. It's become very board specific. So what's happening where I'm working is very different to my board next door. So it's just become this very complicated, chaotic situation for many people. And that when we're working, we're not always sure even what's going to be happening in the next half hour. You know, there'll be new information constantly coming down. You know, we're very excited to be back for sure. I mean, I'm sure anyone going on Twitter and Facebook right now, they're seeing educators from all over Ontario. They're posting their photos of themselves in their shields and their masks and how excited they are. And we are. And I think that's something really important to make clear. We want to be back. We recognize that it's important to be back. But the biggest concern we have right now is that many of us don't feel safe. And as much as we want to be there for the kids in that, and that's what we do, and that's why we do this, when you establish a feeling of instability and not feeling safe, it creates an environment that is not healthy for anyone. And we're doing the best we can, but I think it's a shame that we're going to a start of a new school year, which is always very exciting, with the let's just do the best we can. And that's not the right situation we should have had, given that we've had 7 months for the government to prepare for this. So this is the situation where we're at, that a lot of members that I speak with are not feeling safe. And, just hoping everything works out, they're also sending their own children back to school as well. So they've got this on the double front. They've got the work front, and then they've got their home front. So they're concerned about their own children, concerned about their own families, plus, you know, the students we have at school and ourselves. So it just, it's hitting at you at this triangulation of situation of potential crises that creates a taxing emotional situation for many people. So I think that's where we're at as we've just started back this week. And that's, to summarize, that's how we're feeling based on the people, my members and people I'm speaking with and what we're seeing on Twitter and that too.
So I understand the conflict of emotions that you're describing, the desire to educate, the passion for education, but also the need to protect and ensure a safe work environment for all parties involved. And, you know, I also understand that as I last checked, COVID-19 cases in Ontario are rising again, not necessarily to kind of late April, early May levels, but you know, we could be headed for another potential spike, and this is definitely a potential accelerant of a spike in COVID-19 cases is in schools. So, you know, to put it really bluntly, should schools be reopening at all right now? And if not, what are some of the possible alternatives?
You know, actually, a lot of people have asked that, and we've talked about that a lot as educators. And, you know, I actually think having the schools reopen right now isn't a bad thing. And most of us are, we're okay with schools reopening. So it's not that schools shouldn't be reopening because we see the need from a mental health perspective. Look, the reality is, I mean, the education institution, it is the social order. So it creates the routine, whether for all its cracks, it has the routine, it has stability. It creates relationship for certain students who really need that. So it creates a normalcy in society. So it's not that we're saying, hey, don't be opening. That's not what we're discussing. And that's not what I'm hearing from my education brother and sisters. That's really not the conversation we're having. What we're having is, can we not have the same safety protocols to ensure that, you know, there's as many safety concerns addressed as there are if I go and get my hair cut. You know, I went and had my hair cut the other day and they take my temperature and it's locked and they check me. And it's like the schools, it's like, okay, doors are open and we've got our arrows in that. But, you know, I feel safer in many ways some going to other parts of my community than I do where I work. And, you know, we saw this happen in March with healthcare. And now we're seeing the same thing. We're just not feeling that we're prepared enough. And we had 7 months to plan. We actually had like years to plan because we had SARS, but that's a whole other issue. But I think we do need, in the sense that right now the cases had dropped, we do see a sense that from a mental health perspective, it is good to have the schools open. We are a check for students. No different than in healthcare, we're part of a system of caring. And it's not just about the curriculum, it's also providing that care that's needed as well. You also need it. We have a lot of people who need to go back to work. We know that women in particular, they need childcare and not all can afford it. So there's that issue as well embedded in it. So I don't think any of us, I haven't really heard any educators I know really saying, hey, we shouldn't be opening right now. What we're saying is we're okay opening. And we're happy to open and we're happy to be there for our students, but can you give us a safe environment? And that's workers' rights. That's something that should be an expectation. You know, I can't believe we're having to fight for, hey, can I have, and to make sure that I have, you know, certain things in my room like soap or things like that in some of the boards I'm hearing. You know, the other day, thankfully, I did have a bottle of sanitizer there in the morning, but when I left the night before, it wasn't there. So, you know, we're just, it's always everything's this, can I have it? Is there enough? So it creates that unease. And I think had we had a smoother model of entry, maybe even more of a staggered start, a lot of the boards, mine included, we've done this staggered start, so we have fewer kids entering to begin with until we get the routines down. You know, if we're not ready, let's keep staggering it. And that's something that has been in discussion. And I know some of the boards have staggered and even, okay, we're going to do it this day. We're going to do it this day instead of this day. But that again is always made on a day by day basis. And that's reactive. It's not preventative. And that's the problem. Everything we're doing is reactive. And that doesn't give people a sense of ease. So when the students come in, I'll tell you right now, we are all smiles and everything's great because that's what our profession is about. But the turmoil internalized is there because there's a lot of people who just don't feel that things are where they should be. And it's not just as this is coming right from the top. So it's getting the turmoil is going, okay, well, now you need to do this. So the government says, okay, you're responsible for that. And you need it. We're opening tomorrow. Well, now we have to do that. Well, now we have to check on that. And it becomes this cycle. And I know I sound repetitive, but this is what is how my verbal speech here indicates where we are in trying to understand education right now. Everything's reactive. And that's not good.
Yeah. So you said, so there have been a few reactive, measures taken. But what would you sort of, what would be the safe way to reopen? What are the proactive, what are the ways to get ahead of this that you could do?
Well, one of the things we started, which was good, is that we decided, again, it was last minute, but my board did decide to do a staggered start. So we had just grade nines coming in for a day, and that limited the amount of students. The other thing is smaller class sizes. So we have a two-system education model right now. And so I'm in what's known as a non-designated board. So in my board, it means classes are regular class cap size, whatever we have negotiated in our local collective agreements. So that means that in some of our classes, we can have up to 36 high school students. These are not large rooms. I'm sure you guys remember high school. Imagine, 16-year-olds, 36 of them in a room, no AC, old boiler systems. So that right there is a problem.
Jesus.
Other boards are designated. So certain GTA boards, Toronto, they've been designated and they have a cap of 15. And that came out initially. And that's really hard for me to wrap my head around that. Well, because Toronto area and certain other areas are hotspots, they're capped at 15 and they're doing like a hybrid model with digital learning, synchronous digital learning. But because we're not in a hotspot area, we don't have as many cases, we're back to normal. So I do have colleagues who have 32 in their class, 28 in their class. So there's no social distancing. So that to me is a problem because it just takes one or two. Our elementary model is the same way. So you could have 22 kids. There's 27 kindergarten kids, Imagine little 4 and 5 year olds. Like I've worked in kindergarten for a year before I went into high school. I mean, they're wonderful. I loved it, but there's snot everywhere. It's just the way it is.
Filthy.
I mean, they've
children.
Got a certain kind of snot that just is unique. And that's the nature of education. And we go, okay, whatever, in a normal time. And we're used to getting sick. You tend to have to build up an immunity within a school. You'll notice like when you go to a new school, you might take 2-3 years to sort of build up an immunity. So you're constantly sick for a few years. It's just part of our life. But now we are facing with a pandemic where one sick child can make this difference who comes in asymptomatic, is in a room with 36 other students. Yes, they're in their cohort, but there's not really any social distance. Ultimately, that's a problem. So, when we talk about solutions, class size, there could have been a better way there. So a lot of boards are struggling with that, making sure we're having staggered starts. And then we're still, for those who want to be on the virtual learning, we have a virtual academy. We have a number of students who chose not to come back to school. Their parents decided to enroll them virtually. But I come from a board that has both a city and a rural component, as well as two reservations. So there's certain pockets that we have very little internet. So again, this takes it back to a whole crack in the system where not everyone has access to internet, which means parents have to send them to school because they may not have the internet capabilities. Everything starts compiling. So you can't even say, well, if we do this, virtual learning would work great. Not in rural areas. Well, then we need better internet. Well, that's a whole other aspect. And, you know, I mean, internet in this day and age needs to be sort of almost a fundamental right because we rely on it so much for work and safety and everything. Education being another factor of access to education.
Nationalize the telecoms, folks.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is where your mind starts making all these connections of essentially where the system is cracking and they're getting more and more exposed. So these are some of the solutions we've come up with, and our union presidents have said, can you give us these things? And it's just not happening, you know. And what the ministry has done here, what the government has done here, is they've really loaded it on the school boards very last minute. And it's sort of, you know, the rubber glue situation. And they're like, well, this is what we've said has to happen. Now we're putting it on the boards. And if they're not doing it, that's up to them. Okay. You know, they said, okay, that the boards could use their, some boards have reserve funds. They could use a portion of their additional portion of the reserve funds. A lot of boards don't have reserves. Oh, well, we'll provide this extra money for safety stuff. But not all of it has come through easily. The money's not flowing quickly. I think it was one school board posted that, I believe it was Halton, said it's going to cost them $2 million a month just for disposable masks for their staff. You know, that's, so there's also a funding issue. And we did have federal money come through for which, hey, that's great, we appreciate it, but it's not really trickling down as much as we need. And the province is still, there's some jockeying going on. We're basically saying, where's the money going? Because we're not sure. And it's really difficult right now. So when you factor in a need for cash to make sure that we have everything we need and smaller class sizes, staggered, better internet, those are some safety protocols that would make, I think, a better situation that should have been discussed 7 months ago, not August.
Wow. Money not trickling down to where it needs to go. Imagine my shock. You mentioned the whole class size issue, and I think this is consistent with the pattern of COVID-19 exposing and laying bare the existing contradictions in society that were already there. You know, unions and teachers have been complaining about class sizes since my entire lifetime. And I remember, many moons ago when I was in high school, we thought that 30 kids in a class was a like stupidly high number. And now you're talking about 36 in a pandemic, for Christ's sake. So, yeah, I mean, that aside, I mean, I do want to quickly give a shout out to parents who have been dealing with, having their kids home, not having childcare, not being able to send their kids to school. They're fucking dying right now. They're like, please take my kids from me for the love of God. I'm going to have a mental breakdown. So big ups to all the parents out there. You guys are amazing. You mentioned the whole distance, like online learning thing, and barriers to accessible internet aside, online learning is like objectively horrible. It's not good. But in a pandemic situation where we need to social distance and we need to reduce the spread of this fucking virus as much as we possibly can, do you think that this online learning can play a role? But on the other hand, do you think that normalizing online learning where you could shove 200 kids into a classroom?
You know exactly what the universities have done is normalize online learning swiftly and abruptly.
Yeah, and charge just as much for it. But do you fear that if that's normalized, that could be a model? My cat's fucking around. Sorry. Do you worry that normalizing virtual distance learning could pose kind of an existential threat to the education system, where they're like, well, we shoved 200 kids into a virtual class during coronavirus, why can't we do it afterwards and cut the budget?
So the thing is, we've actually been doing online learning for over a decade. It actually isn't new, even though the Ontario government, I mean, you heard during last year's strike, and that was one of the things, because here in Ontario they were trying to make it mandatory for 4 courses, but it's not new, but it's always been an option for students. So I think actually there's students who do very well with it. I know some students actually found that with the situation in the spring, they actually found it worked for them, but overall it hasn't been great. I think the feedback we've received is that a lot of students aren't comfortable with it. Yeah. Barriers aside with the internet issues and that, having computers, you know, all these things, having time. But for some, it is a good thing. In terms of normalization, the one good thing I can say is that I'm really proud that I have a strong union. Last year, I was on the picket lines advocating against this mandatory learning. The other problem is how it's done. So right now we have, it has to be synchronous, which means it has to be so many minutes a day at set times. That's not how online learning works well. You know, there is a problem with, from a racial perspective, that there's a phenomenal woman and researcher, Behan Farhadi, here in Ontario, who's done a lot of work on that, using Toronto neighborhoods as an example. So we have a lot to still deal with online learning. I don't think it's going to be normalized, only in the sense that after this spring, there was a lot of parents not happy with it. A lot of students spoke out about it. And I think where unfortunately, with our current government, the push is coming just from a financial cash cow, underfunding, as you said. I don't know if it's going to be normalized, though, from a societal perspective. I think there'll be a fight against it. But you're right, though. Look what we've seen in post-secondary, more and more going online. And yet, at the same time, it's not as receiving the accolades that it should. So I'm really hoping not. It's something we're fighting. I think it needs to be, it's just a tool. And for some students, it's effective, but not all. And when you look at our ministry documents, the whole point is that we're supposed to always find tools that work for different students as needed. And I think it really, this comes down from really government ideology. And we're dealing here in Ontario with a government that just doesn't understand this concept of learning, be it online or in class. So they just see it as saving money. It's easy. You've got to be, you know, capable of doing all these things. You know, good luck getting, I just say to our government, good luck getting a 4 or 5 year old to sit the required 180 minutes to do synchronous learning. You know, hang around a 5 year old. They don't all want to sit on a computer doing schoolwork for 180 minutes, breaks in there or not. So it's just using it appropriately. And it can be a really good source of learning, but it has to be done appropriately, which includes feedback, normal class sizes. You know, post-secondary, you can't give adequate feedback with 200 kids. I dread the idea of that happening, where I've got a grade 9 class teaching English or math, trying to give all that feedback. Like, it's just not possible. I think parents would be in an uproar. I just don't see that happening. And thankfully, our union's going to fight that one for sure. I have no doubt.
I totally get it. You know, coming from the perspective of somebody in the university system myself, there's definitely something kind of cutthroat about the Swift implementation of online learning as more so the norm rather than the rule, kind of very soon after the pandemic hit and now continuing into the new school year as it starts. But, you know, if I could speculate about the cause for the difference between the kind of mixed approach in implementing online as a tool that I hear you describing in secondary and then post-secondary going to exclusively online, it's like we kind of know that high schools and, you know, all of the K-12 system serves as part of the unit of social reproduction and the education of youth in not a kind of not merely in the sense of professionalization, but, you know, enculturing them as human beings who can function in a society. And, you know, after their university age, we've kind of released them into the savage world of cutthroat capitalism. And so we could be a little more disaffected. But, you know, that really speaks to me of something interesting that you said, which is the perspective of the parents and their involvement in the politics of the reopening of schools K-12 at this time. And what do you make of their perspective? Do you find that parents who you've talked to are more so in favor of the reopening of the schools, or are they kind of hesitant about things going forward?
You know, I've been teaching now, this is coming up my 12th year, because I did other things before, but I've never seen since last year this sense of support from parents. And I think they actually really started to use their voice to really speak up for education. So I see parents overall as an ally, and for which I'm very grateful. And I know most educators that I speak with would say the exact same thing. Since last year, we've had that surge of parental support. And the nice thing is that, well, nice isn't the right word. With the two models that we do have, parents have been able to make a choice to a certain degree. So they can choose to send their child back to school, or they can choose the virtual option in my board. I also know some parents are holding back. In my local neighborhood, I live in a downtown area, and a number of parents I've spoken to, and my neighbors, they're going to wait a week or two. They want to see how things show up and what happens. They're a little hesitant. You know, some parents are stuck. They have to send their kids. You know, but I don't feel this sense of I don't feel this sense of anger at us, the educators. It's more their confusion as well. So they're trying to understand the information as it comes out. They're trying to make all these decisions. So I feel for parents because they're making tough choices. And these are their children. And this is what boggles my mind. You know, we're not talking about education. We're talking about children. And it's everything we're trying to do is just to make sure that whatever happens and whatever choices are made, they're protected. That's how we focus as educators. We always are thinking what's good for them. And when we're good, they're good. And we know that. That's why we want to be safe, so that they're safe. They get it, it all balances out. So from a parent point of view, they're much more allyship than I've ever seen in the previous 10 years. There's always some naysayers. Occasionally you'll see a Twitter or hear someone shout out something. But overall, parents are really supportive and very understanding. We've had, you know, little glitches here and there in my role and what I do. I interact with a lot of parents, and they've been very understanding and will work through it. So the pressure from the parents hasn't been there like I was worried that it might be, because they've got their own anxieties. But from the parent point of view, it's not really been as much of a factor in terms of us being overwhelmed, at least. But I do think the parents, what we saw during the strike situation last year, is that they really spoke out, and we saw the power of the parents, and we saw the power of community, And we really saw for the first time how their voices as activists, as this group, could change things. You know, between our union activism and community and parental support, and trust me, that parental support was massive. We saw from what they originally proposed with our very first bargaining situation to what ended up happening, dramatic shifts. So it's nice to see that parents are really speaking up, and they are part of this model, and they're important to acknowledge in this model because it's their kids. And that's the concern where we're always thinking of what's best for the kids.
I think that, the lack of education and lack of schools is not only, again, with the pattern of laying bare the contradictions in society that have been there all the time. But schools don't just provide education. They don't just provide socialization for kids and a, you know, social network for them and whatnot. But there's the issue of nutrition. Especially in terms of low income children who get a lot of their nutrition from free school meals, school lunches and stuff like that. And they might not come from or live in households that are financially able to provide them with nutritious food on a regular basis. How have you seen, like, over the last 7 months where we haven't had public schools open, how have you seen that this is affecting low-income residents and communities? Do you think that, and do you think that it's kind of maybe highlighting the important role that schools play in providing nutrition to low-income kids?
I'm going to take a little step further. I'm going to go beyond nutrition because this everything you're talking about really is a poverty issue. So nutrition's part of that poverty issue, and that is the biggest barrier in education, period. So we're always talking about issues related to socioeconomics, nutrition being one of them. So what happened in the spring, we always had these food, all the schools have a variety of different food programs depending on their school population. The school at which I was and still am at, so we have a lot of students who require a number of snack products and different help on a nutrition basis. So in the spring, any food that we had, our school donated to the community. What I have heard in the community is that I do know families, the numbers have gone up for intake for the food bank. We know that for sure. That happened right away. These are their families. So this is impacting the kids from a nutrition point of view as well. We know that there have been a lot of interest in our various community meal programs. We do have some teen programs that had to be closed. They provided a lot of nutrition as well. And so that was all gone. We're not sure of, we've just started, so we haven't seen the direct impact. Right now, we don't have the snacks to give out and the food programs to do. We're not able to serve in our cafeteria. So we have a cafeteria where we have a food program that's part of our courses, which also gives access for students who maybe don't have a lunch. It's a way to provide lunch. You know, different schools do that, sort of an emergency meal so that students have meals. Those aren't able to be provided. Snack programs, we are hoping, will get up running again to help students for nutrition. Because we have found out that we can give away packaged food. So that means like we can't, you know, take apples and give out apples, but we could give out granola bars. It's not perfect, but it's food. But yeah, it's not just nutrition, it's food, it's clothing. So we normally have in most of our schools an additional clothing, a closet, so that students can get boots or shoes, and that's donations from the community. That won't be open. So that's going to be an issue. We have, you know, students who don't have even just required pencils and pens. So just even, you know, every day we're always giving out supplies. It's what we do. So trying to find different ways to cope with that. And it sounds silly, but it's like normally like, oh, just use this. So now we can't share resources. So we've got to make sure every student has those resources. but we don't always have them available. So, you know, this is, when you look at it, this is all about poverty, making sure students have everything. We'll adjust. As educators, we're used to finding ways to be creative. We'll find ways to make sure students have what they need, but does it have an impact? Yes. And this, we all know as educators, if you want to improve education, you deal with poverty, because that is the key. You deal with food, you deal with housing, you deal with, you know, clothing, all these basic necessities of life. You can't learn when you're worrying about that you're starving or you don't have somewhere to live. So again, this is exposing all those cracks in the system that impact education. And when you look at education, it's about society as a whole. Like you were saying, it's not just this building. We're part of a bigger community and we're part of societal normalization, all these different things. And it's hard. You know, it gets very emotional at times because, you know, we do see these students come in and we are part of the community. I just, you know, I ran into a student just this morning out in the market and, you know, knowing different things about their family, hoping that they're okay. And you worry, we do worry. And I don't think everyone always understands that. We're very much like a lot of industries like healthcare and social work. We have that compassion with us and it's connecting all that together. But yeah, we'll find a way to make sure kids are fed. Most of us will pull stuff. We spend out of our own pockets. None of us ever want to see a kid go hungry. But it's going to be a little more creative than we're used to, that's for sure. And we are looking forward to when the snack programs get back up and running, though. That'll make a huge difference in our community.
Salute the troops, everyone.
Yeah, something I wanted to ask about is sort of a, I guess, a bigger question kind of related to, well, the whole situation. So, like, Corona's changed how everyone's jobs work to some extent or another. Like, how has the pandemic made you feel about your role as an educator and an activist? I mean, has your job sort of changed its actual purpose or anything like that? Like, you know, you talk about, you know, engagement with the community and things, but has the job itself shifted?
It's hard to say because I've always been more of a well-rounded educator. I've done a lot of special education. So for me as an educator, I've worked in quite a bit of self-contained programs. So a lot of focus on life skills, vocational skills. So I come from a little bit of a unique perspective, I think, when I think of my role, because I'm thinking, hey, you know what, they're 16, they can apply to the housing list now so that maybe we can get them on the housing list so that they have somewhere to live later on when they're graduated school and things like that. So my perspective is a little unique. So I think in terms of how we've shifted with the pandemic, with a focus on that holistic needs of students, I've always had that. So I don't think my role has changed. I do think, though, for many educators, they're recognizing that as students are starting to come in, that this is the priority. You know, we're checking in on them, making sure how they've been for 7 months. Are they even here? You know, we have amazing attendance counselors who are trying to find students. That's their role because we haven't had contact and they may not have enrolled. You know, we have all these different people doing these different jobs. In terms of union, it's actually been really interesting watching with the pandemic. And even within our own union, it's really great to see some of the dialogue and discourse that we're having juxtaposed with what's happening with Defund the Police and Black Lives Matters and starting to also unravel our own systemic barriers. And I think that's been really fascinating to watch as an activist, to even go further as a labor institution to really understand what our role in is that and where changes can be made. So I have seen that already happening with my own union in a very positive way, that we're starting to look at ourselves differently. I am pleased to say that my board, we're because of different individuals involved, this year our grade 11 English class they're actually doing, it's, we have in our curriculum both an Indigenous Studies English, so it's all to do with Indigenous orature, literature, curriculum focus, and then the regular English, you know, Shakespeare or whatever teacher chooses. Not all do Shakespeare, but so this year, all grade 11 students will be doing in our board this Indigenous focused based understanding of orature and literature. So that's exciting to see. So I know some of our English teachers are really excited in context of what's been happening over the pandemic. So you're going to, I see a lot of change in that program. So, I mean, the pandemic has definitely raised those kind of awareness and issues amongst ourselves. I think it's also, like I said, it's exposed a lot of cracks. We've talked about it in a variety of ways, but it's definitely exposed cracks in education that, hey, our HVAC sucks because the schools haven't been looked after. We're still on, a lot of our schools are on boilers and there's no air conditioning and it's, you know, there's no circulation and the windows may not open and, you know, there's mice infestations stations maybe, or I don't know, but you know, it's starting to get those conversations running that, oh, HVAC is kind of important. Let's talk about that. So it's changing perhaps the public perception of our system. But as an educator, I think it just depends on the role that you're in. So for me, it's, I've always been a whole student focus because of the nature of my role. But that's not to say others aren't. It's, I don't feel that my role is going to shift too much. It's still always the focus of the student. What do they need? That's always my first thing. What do they need? Be it food, be it someone to help them, be it whatever, need a course, like what do they need? That's how I operate.
It's great to hear about that, especially considering the domineering presence of a massive force that doesn't particularly give any fucks, the Doug Ford government. This is our necessary Doug sesh. And what can you tell us about the how the Ford government in Ontario has screwed over the public school system in Ontario? Give us the dirt.
Yeah,
I don't even know where to begin.
We can't have a talk about education with an Ontario teacher without slagging off the Ford government. So please, gift us with your perspective.
We left the saltiest part for the end.
It's so honestly overwhelming at times. You know, it's funny. I spoke with a teacher who's an older teacher, still teaching, and they're awesome. And they were around during the Harris years. And they said way back in, like, I guess January, February, they said they felt that this situation, this government, was worse than the Harris years. They truly felt that. You know, honestly, I can only describe it from my perspective. I feel like I'm at war. I feel like I'm, like, in the trenches. It's exhausting. We are exhausted. Our union leaders are working their butts off locally, and they're exhausted. They've had meetings, like, constantly. I don't even know where to begin with Ford. It's just, for us, actually, as educators, our big one is Minister Lecce. I'm sure you've seen the trends of on Twitter of Lying Lecce is a very popular hashtag on Twitter. You know, this is a government that has an ideology of privatization. We have people leading education who have no understanding. We have Minister Lecce, who went to private school, then went to Western, and right out of Western was hired by Harper in one of, I think, his communications department, owns a communications, public communications firm. So this is not someone who understands public education. We have our premier, which is hard to say, Doug Ford, who... education is not a strong suit. Can we just say that? Like, come on. And then, yeah, like, let's just, yeah, I mean, it doesn't even need to be said. You know exactly what we're all thinking.
Imagine my shock.
You know, who honestly, truly, I think, believes that he can just buy his way into everything, including an education. And then you have our assistant, our assistant, Sam Oosterhoff, who is, I think he's 22 now, and who was homeschooled. And he, him and Lecce
get out of town.
Are education gurus, and, you know, has never been in a public school. And you just look like, come on, you know, and this is where you sense the sense of privilege from these guys that do you not recognize the struggle and have an understanding that, you know, this is affecting whole communities. You know, I don't think they truly understand that education is not just this is a school and you can sell off the curriculum as a commodity, because that's, I think, how they see it. Like, hey, we can create this and sell it here and things like that. And that's how I think they saw eLearn, as an opportunity to sell it, because we do have a lot of foreign students who choose to come here and pay tuition to come here to go to high school. I honestly think that was part of their thinking. They see it as commodity that you can sell, and that success means you get a really good job with big money. And they don't see that whole complex relationship that happens between educators. And let's just be clear, educators are not just teachers. I'm talking everyone, custodian. Our school secretaries are like the queens and kings, mostly queens, because that's the women I know. But they run the school. Like, I don't know what we'd do without them. You know, these are our social workers, our cultural mentors. We have a number of cultural mentors. So, I mean, this is not just teachers, but they just see this as being just this commodification. And it's hard to reason with them. I honestly have this sense that it's not that they're not aware. I don't know if they care. And that, I don't even know where to go with that. And I mean, you see, if anyone who follows Twitter, if you follow any educators on Twitter, you'll see it. I'm sure you guys have. It just boggles the mind. You can't always get straight answers. They'll say one thing, but that's not happened. You know, they make this big announcement. Hey, we're going to give $50 million for new HVAC. Yeah, but it came in August. Where are you going to get the ductwork? Where are you going to get the tradespeople? Do you know the tendering process that happens in school boards? It's not like, hey, we're going to just put in a whole new air conditioning system. Like, just, it isn't going to happen, folks. But it's all about this public relations and putting it out there on the media. And if I see one more Lecce video with the music in the background and him saying, we're here for you, and all the other stuff, I can't even watch it anymore. I totally tuned out. Don't even get, like, I could keep going. I'm sorry. I'll just keep ranting, because it's been 2 years of this and it's exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting.
No, we're perfectly okay with you ranting. Let the hate flow through you.
Oh, yeah. I go on. Like, you know, you see a new announcement and we're all, all of a sudden all my text goes off and my messenger goes off and we're all going like, oh, my gosh, did you see or did you read? And we're like, yeah, like we're flummoxed. It's just the sense of, are you kidding me? And then there's these big announcements made to the public. And it's like, but that's not happened. That's not happened. You know, and they're like, oh, we're going to be hiring more this, this, and this. It's like, okay, well, you've got the money, but you do realize that, you know, that's great. You're going to get the boards. You're telling them to hire more custodians. Well, most boards are hiring casual custodians. That's like $15 an hour, $16 an hour, no benefits, no sick leave, day to day, driving all over different places. They could be safer working for a little bit, you know, at minimum wage, essentially at McDonald's, than taking this. So where are you going to get all these people? Like, this is where, you know, they make these big announcements. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, no concept. And yeah, and just not understanding how the system works. Like, well, what are we going to do about our occasional teachers and occasional custodians and occasional EAs? These are people who go into a variety of different schools. There's no cohorts for them. You know, trying to work out there's no discussion about it. None. It's like, well, they're traveling into potentially every single school, but they're not even on discussion. I mean, most of the time, Lecce and Ford won't even use the word educator. They use the word teacher all the time. And then it just becomes a sense of, you know, they'll say on the one day, well, we really appreciate our teachers. And then the next day you get something, you know, the other day they slammed my union president, Harvey Bischoff. You know, he's just a guy with an English degree. I'm like, you're kidding me, right? Like, that's what you come back with? So this is where it's this antagonistic relationship. You know, I have my union thug t-shirt. I wear it proudly. But this is where we're made to be these bad guys. And yeah, it's like, come on, we're just saying we need this, this, and this, and this. That's all we're saying. We're not asking, I think, for too much. I'm asking that, hey, make sure that every single educator person working in our schools in all across Ontario has PPE when they need it without having to worry about, you know, how many times has it been disinfected and has it gone over the 19-day maximum or am I sharing it with someone else? I mean, literally, that's where I've heard some of the occasional teachers are concerned. They've been told they're going to have to share it as they go in each day. Not in my board, but a different board. But like, we're not asking for the moon here. We're asking to be safe. And yet we're made to be these villains. And it's create this divisiveness, which we know the conservatives love, but it's very divisive. And this hatred of teachers. And I say teachers because that's the word they use, but it's just constant. So it feels like you're constantly being assaulted. And, you know, these are, I work with some amazing, caring individuals, and this is not how they work. Like they're just kind people. And yeah, at the same time, you're vilified. You know, there are times where I don't even want to tell people I'm in education, let alone a teacher, because you don't know what reaction you're going to get because it's spewed this hate and divisiveness. But yeah, it's exhausting. We are absolutely exhausting. I could go on about this government like you wouldn't believe. So my husband gets sick of it, I tell you, because every day it's like, what now? It's absolute fabrication and a sense of just almost betrayal. There's no relationship, in my opinion. You know, it's just, what can they take from us? And they will take and take and take. So I, you know, and thankfully we have strong unions and we have leaders who will stand up and speak. And I'm very grateful for all the leaders who've been working together because we can't take that on too. So they've been under that attack. And I do appreciate all the leaders of all our education unions because it's a lot, it's daily, and we can't keep up.
Well, you know, I have to say I'm shocked that a private homeschooled person being put in charge of public education would have this sort of effect. I mean, who could have seen this coming?
Well, it's not just that. Conservatism is a brain virus and, you know, of a shared strain with liberalism and neoliberalism, I'm sure. But one thing you can be damn sure about in all of these conservative reactionary types is the need to attack public services. If they can't privatize it, they'll commodify it in whatever way they can to extract scraps of value, which I think you've described very well. It's vile, right? Like they represent just this balance of class power that is struggling to lurch into the, you know, next zombified stage of this late stage capitalist crisis that we are in and that's coming apart at the seams.
The only thing we keep saying is like, and this is sad, but a lot of us are saying, but it could be worse. It could be Alberta. You know, we've had people say that. And I'm like, that's the measure by which we're measuring ourselves? Like, well, really?
Holy shit, that's so frustrating. And I find, I mean, again, kind of calling back to our episode that we did on the Canadian healthcare system, the conversation always starts and ends at least we're not America. And so, therefore, you're not able to criticize Canada because we're not, you know, skinny kid at fat camp. I'm sorry. I know that's kind of a bad phrase, but it's descriptive.
Yeah. And I don't see what the problem is asking for more. And, you know, we get vilified a lot because, well, look how much you earn and your summer's off and this and that. And it's like, hey, I want more for everyone. You know, I don't want someone who is in charge right now of cleaning my school and keeping us all safe, who's working their butt off. I want them to be earning a lot more money and making sure that they can afford a home and everything else, because right now they may not be able to. Like, I don't think it's wrong for us to say to invest in people. You know, I mean, this is where my political bias comes out, shocker. But, you know, the reality is, if you take care and make sure that people have what they need, what do most people want? They want a home. They want to be able to make sure their children are safe. They want to make sure their children have access to education. They want to make sure they have food and be able to have this sense of quality of life without stressing about paying for every little thing that, hey, my hydro is going to be shut down next week because I can't afford it. You know, I don't think we're asking for a lot. And yet from a political with this government, it's like, how dare we as educators try and protect our schools and ourselves? And it blows my mind, and it's exhausting.
How dare you get in the way of capital from trouncing over everyone?
But hey, they'll say they've got a great plan and it was approved, and you know, look how great it is, and the Ontario medical doctor approved it and they're the experts. You know, my attitude is like, you know, I hope none of us get sick. Like, no one wants anyone to get sick. I hope all of this and everything I've said and all my fears end up being, you know, for naught. But I think the problem is that where I have an issue is if that happens, it's not because the plan was good. It's in spite of the plan. And that's where I struggle with. We didn't learn from SARS. We didn't do the prevention required that was recommended in a variety of institutions, you know, long-term care. You know, education is another area where you have that similar concept. You know, we haven't learned from that. We didn't learn from March. So if everything goes okay and our numbers stay low, it's not because of a good plan. It's in spite of a plan, and it's because of people who've worked really hard. And I don't know if that's recognized. I don't know what to do with that. You know, I feel like sometimes I'm Chicken Little with the sky is falling, but at the same time, that's part of prevention. When you invest in prevention, you know that you can face things better. And I don't think that's really been the way things have gone in education.
Okay, well, I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. Anthony, Mac, did you guys have any other questions or things you wanted to mention?
Just one quick one, actually. Yeah, Adrian, you mentioned the union solidarity and your respect for all the other heads and members of other education unions in Ontario. And that's obviously the best way to combat the reactionary forces in power and really see through some of your demands. How can some of our listeners who may or may not be involved with those unions show their solidarity?
You know, just constantly writing to their members of provincial parliament is huge. You know, calling them, writing them, being outspoken. You know, look, we're not looking for big hurrahs. What we really want is change. So we've seen the impact of public pressure. So keep putting that public pressure on, because it's allyship. You know, and that's not just us. That's for healthcare and a variety of labor movements and activism. You know, we've got to show that labor solidarity, and that comes from the public as well. And it's great to see what we have and just keep that momentum going, because it is exhausting. We know people sort of get tired of hearing about it, but at the same time, it does have an impact. You know, eventually you hope that your government listens to you. And if enough people speak up, it strengthens us all and change can happen. So that's the best thing I think most of us want, you know, and just know that we're looking after your kids. You know, we do put them first. We do care about your kids. When they are entrusted to us, we truly honor that trust, and we respect it for what it is. So thank you, because we do appreciate it. So I just want to say big thanks there to the parents who entrust us with their children, you know, 6-8 hours a day. That's a lot. Thank you.
Well, I want to say thank you as an educator, and I have to say that public school teachers have been some of the most positive influences in my life, and you seem like someone who genuinely cares about kids and their education and their well-being, and I thank you for that. I salute the troops, the public school teachers, and you know, I thank you for what you do every day in your line of work, helping out kids and making sure that they are taken care of and get a good education.
The high school teacher that we all wanted but never had.
There are some awesome ones out there. There really are.
We all have one, hopefully, right? Like, I can remember one or two high school teachers who made a profound impact on my life, you know?
Oh, I had some rad school teachers. This interview was absolutely fucking fantastic. Thank you so much. And
let's hope I don't get in trouble with my board. But hey.
Well, if you need us to release like a censored version with the F bombs bleeped out, I can do that.
Oh, that I don't give a shit about. But no,
okay. Well, I just want to, while we're talking about public high school teachers, I just want to give a quick shout out to Mrs. Bevan and Mrs. Richardson, who were among my top influences when I was young. They were absolutely fucking fantastic and changed my life. I love public school teachers. You guys are the best.
Well, have a great night. What time is it there for you? 5 o'clock? Yeah.
Well, it's hard to tell because I can't see the fucking sun.
Blah, blah, blah. I can't see the sun. It's cloudy in BC.
It's not cloudy. It's smoke. It's nuclear winter smoke.
It's not nuclear winter smoke. It's a forest fire from California.
Washington.
Okay. Our air quality is worse than Beijing or Delhi right now.
Yeah,
okay,
right now.
I've been in Delhi. I doubt it's as bad as Delhi because it was really hard in Delhi. So
I'm just reporting the CBC's liberal rag that I heard while I was driving to the recycling depot. So I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
apparently
know.
Yeah, it is. But it's not. It has been way worse other years. Occasionally, like this is really not that bad.
Mac,
do you get this every year?
No. Mac, shut the fuck up. This is horrible.
Oh, tell me more about how it's nuclear winter, Ben. I'm not exaggerating. It's just the end of the world.
Hey, if it's functionally the same as nuclear winter,
no,
then it might as
it
well
isn't
be.
You're lying. You're just lying. That's it.
So you just watched Chernobyl last week. Now everything is nuclear winter.
Good times, good times. All right, my husband's glaring at me, so I'd be quiet for like an hour, and I think it's killing him, so.
Thanks for the update from the nuclear winter of education out east, Adrienne. It was really great chatting with you.
All right, have a great night. So I'm so glad I actually get to see your faces. Woohoo! I like that. Take care. Bye. Yeah,
cheers. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. That was a fantastic interview. That was a pleasure. Hope you all enjoyed. And we have I want to apologize for the, you know, hiatus of episodes. We were on a little bit of a break, but we are back. We've got a bunch of new episodes lined up. We hope you enjoy all of them. Thank you for listening. We are signing off from the Gulag Archipelago of Soviet Kanakistan.